not just in D.C., but also made in Langley or in Fort Benning, because the people who perpetrated this coup, who pulled it off, were trained in the School of the Americas. They became the, I think, 11th set of generals trained in Fort Benning and the School of the Americas, who pulled off a coup and, we almost have to say, set up a dictator, a new dictator in Honduras. The person whom they replaced was one of the major families in Honduras, not democratically elected, and the person they ousted was a democratically elected president of that country by the name of Manuel Zelaya. What was the precipitating cause? There might have been a number, such as the hostility that the major landowners and the families that dominate Honduras, the concern they felt, because Zelaya, while he was one of them, he came from one of those families. He had begun to show definite signs of a positive influence from that democratic sweep that is sweeping across Central and South America. He had established positive conversations with Brazil, with Venezuela. He had done something unprecedented by any members of those families that economically dominate historically Honduras. He had shown a definite tendency to be supportive of the peasant, the poor, the poorest of the poor in Honduras. And he took a very bold and unprecedented move of taking measures to increase the minimum wage of the campesinos, the garifonos, the poor people throughout the country by 60%. And when he did that, he obviously precipitated a lot of grumbling from the cabal, the group that eventually took over. And they called in the chips from the general, the head of the army. But there was another precipitating factor. In Honduras, the election to office only lasts for one term. That's in their constitution. There were many people who had long hoped for the possibility that a person to run for office could stand or run for office, at least a second or third time. But rather than try to force that issue, what Zelaya did was to promote or propose to the people of the country that there should be a popular petition from the masses requesting the National Assembly to convene to invoke a special process that could lead to review of the Constitution and the possibility of a change in the Constitution. And that really, it would seem, shivers down the spines of those heads of the various families who probably saw themselves standing in line to be, quote, democratically elected. As a result of that, that proposal made by Zelaya, at least 600,000 petitions were signed by the poor people of the country who did not have a history or a tradition of publicly petitioning their government for major change. they always were faithfully obedient to the major families that they worked for. And they began to show independence and a desire for forms of democracy in their own electoral system, such as we have seen happening in some of the other Latin American countries in the region. The people spoke and said they wanted to convene the special process through which there could be a start towards review of their constitution. The general of the army, since it's the army's responsibility to distribute the ballot boxes, refused to distribute the ballot boxes. The plan was that there would be three ballot boxes for persons who were running for office and a separate ballot box for the people to vote to express their desire to have this special process. And when the general refused to order the soldiers to distribute those boxes, what happened is a few nights later, at 3 o'clock in the morning, they broke the doors and tore down, beat open some of the doors, took the democratically elected president out of bed, shipped him off to another country, reminiscent of the way in which the coup was pulled off against Aristide and Haiti. To make a longer story short, to sort of cut to the chase, just day before yesterday, maybe some of you being here haven't heard this, but Zelaya did return. He is in the Brazilian embassy. He's been granted residence and welcomed by the Brazilian embassy. But he is in the country under threat of death. Mm-hmm. You know, an order to shoot has been given by the current president, Micheletti, and the army is on the lookout. If they find him, they really don't have to just arrest him. They can shoot him. Now, what has the U.S. done in the face of all of this? In order to understand the duplicity, the cowardice, the lack of serious response to this violent act against the democratically elected president that has come from the Obama administration, let's put it in historical context. The U.S. essentially owned Honduras and has for a number of generations. Nothing happens in Honduras without the USOA. There would be no coup in Cuba without some form of agreement, complicity, or looking the other way by the U.S. The U.S. has the power to cut the economy of Nicaragua as fast as that. What happened, first of all, President Obama correctly referred to what had happened as a military coup. But within a matter of hours, the word came from the U.S. State Department talking about trouble in Cuba, but not defining it
Honduras.
As a coup, let alone a military coup.
Honduras.
There has not been a very clear answer to some of the questions that I think the U.S. needs to be held accountable for. Why was Erich Reisch in Cuba at the time of the in Honduras, at the time of the school? You know who Reisch is? He was one of the compatriots, companions with the person who was on the CIA payroll, who shot down the airplane just off of Bermuda in 1973, killing 76 Cubans who were returning from the Pan American Games, and who has been in various stages of flight, but now he is walking free in the U.S. It's an example of the duplicity in the U.S. about the dealings with terrorism. The U.S. is opposed to terrorism as long as it's persons that they define as U.S. assets, such as Reich was. The way in which the U.S. labels some who violate basic human rights and democracy and doesn't dismiss or define others as terrorists is based upon U.S. self-interest. So the U.S. foreign policy in the region is dependent upon what's in the interest of the U.S., not what's in the interest of the welfare and the rights of the people of whatever country it is, whether it's Guatemala or earlier Nicaragua or throughout the region. So the U.S. has not answered any of those questions, and I think we ought to be demanding answers from the U.S. about why the presence of persons known to have a history of terrorist activity in the region at the time that this coup happened. Why has there not been an offer by the U.S. itself to offer asylum to Zelaya? Why has the U.S. not taken strong actions to impose economic sanctions against Honduras, which it could do very, very easily? These are some of the outstanding questions. But I want to just point out that the real story, what I consider the most fundamentally significant story in the news over the last 3 months, or more than 85 days and counting now, has been beyond the fact that every other nation in the region has refused to recognize the Micheletti government, the coup regime. Beyond the fact that they have no legitimacy among any governments in the world except the U.S. The real story that many of our news reporters, the commercial press, certainly don't get, or at least don't report. Only progressive, isolated media coverage will point out what I think is the real story. The real story, the most significant reality that we can all feel proud and good about, is the resistance of the Honduran people. This is unprecedented. I can't remember ever a time in Honduras when the power of the ruling classes of those, I think, 10, 12 families that dominate the economy and all of the political and economic interests of Honduras. I can't remember a time when the population, the farm workers, the peasants, the poor, Garifuno, up on the coast, all collectively rose up almost as a total mass and resisted the power of the army and the power of the ruling classes. And we're not talking about a day or two. You see, the demonstrations by the masses throughout the country, not just in the capital, but in the small towns, in the rural areas, places that aren't even covered by, you know, AP and Reuters and BBC. But the information that has come out through a number of progressive sources is that these demonstrations are taking place all over the country. Even when the army has imposed curfew, they would impose a curfew from 6 o'clock in the evening to 6 o'clock the next morning. And then at about 5:30 the next morning, while people are out demonstrating, sleeping in the squares, protesting, resisting, they would announce a new period of curfew from 6 o'clock that morning until 6 o'clock the next day. So it's impossible for those who are resisting to not be in violation of the curfew law, a very intentional strategy of entrapping people.
Mm-hmm.
But still, by the scores of thousands in the smallest of towns, and by some accounts, hundreds of thousands in major cities like Tegucigalpa, they're out there, they're resisting, they're fighting. This is powerfully important, and they deserve our support in every possible way. We need to be in solidarity with them because this is a historic development. The tactics that are being used are very typically the tactics that are taught in the school of the Americas. Rapes. We don't really hear about the rapes. One of the very progressive bloggers, I want to give you an address which I brought. For those of you who are more technically competent than I am, www.youtube.com. Very good coverage. It's a refreshing comfort to the commercial media coverage of what's happening in Nicaragua. The truth is that there are, we don't even know the numbers of people who have been put, that they've been arrested and placed in stadia, the stadiums around the country. Very reminiscent of what happened in Chile and other South American countries under coups that were staged by graduates of the Latin American, of the School of the Americas. Their primary purpose is to train the military, they call them security forces, for Latin America. But their history of fomenting pretenses for invoking coups, and then sometimes bloody and sometimes in a less bloody manner, but achieving the same objectives. People thrown in jail, people put in stadia where they languish without legal support of counsel. The use of billy clubs. There was one story that just made me want to get up and go down and immediately had that kind of impact. Was a mother, old enough to be the mother of some of those young soldiers who had raped her. And then reminiscent of New York and some other cities where police have taken to using their batons to sexually abuse their victims. But this is happening even as we're here. And the conditions, in a sense, were getting worse and worse, and we hope that the return of Zelaya will help to calm the situation a bit. But already, even though he has been there only a couple of days, what I call the tendency of the media to blame the victim is evident in the coverage from commercial media. There is, if you read the papers and you read between the lines and you kind of hear what is being said, they're tying the return of Zelaya to the arousal of violence. They're blaming the violence on him. They say nothing about the murders. They say nothing about the arrests. They say nothing about the endless detentions. They say nothing about the way in which, you know, women have been abused and young men have been shot at gunpoint, which they're doing. But the return of Zelaya is now being hailed in the commercial press as an occasion for violence, and they're attacking the people in the Brazilian embassy, even to the point that there's been some discussion about the possibility that there might be an attack on the Brazilian embassy. That's how desperate these guys are. And who knows how it's going to unfold or where it will end. But it is very clear that we need to be very active in every way possible in our support. We need to call the White House, we need to call the U.S. State Department, and we need to do everything we can to get our own members of Congress committed to opposing the coup. There are two bills in the Congress, one by a group of conservative members of the U.S. Congress who have a bill that calls for a support for the coup regime. And then there's the other, and that one, fortunately, so far only has about 24 votes. But the bill that's in the Congress that is being moved through and appeals are being made to get some members of the Congress to sign on has almost double the number of supporters, but that's only 42. So this ambivalence of the U.S. is very evident, and we need a popular response to press our own government to act more responsibly. Those are Reverend Smith here. Okay. When he comes back, let's Carla ask if there's a way to make copies of the press release that came out the MIFCO yesterday.
Do you have it?
I think it was sent to him, to his address. So these are just a few highlights. I think that we need to call for the unequivocal support of the return to power of the democratically elected president, Manuel Zelaya. We need to call for the imposition of full economic and trade sanctions on the coup regime, and an end to all the violence and repression that's being perpetrated by the military under this new regime, the coup regime. Are there any questions or comments or further information that any of you have that you'd like to share?
How can we get involved with the work that CASA received in IFCO or
IFCO takes caravans to various countries. We were planning a caravan to Honduras and Nicaragua at the time that the coup happened. We, in consultation with some of our friends and counterparts on the ground, people that we were going to with aid, such as Dr. Luther Harry Castillo, who was a graduate of the Latin American School of Medicine, and he returned. Agatocono returned, built a new clinic, hospital in his hometown, the first time there has been a hospital in that region of the coast that's heavily populated by Agatocono. And we decided that we need to do everything possible to focus attention on Washington, to do the same thing we're trying to impress upon you to do and that will be the focus. We have three staff people who are going to Washington. They'll be at the Congressional Black Caucus, and we'll be trying to work with Congress members and generate popular support for Honduras. That's a part of what we're doing, and eventually we intend to go with a caravan. But in order to know about the caravans that we do, I hope you'll all take one of these flyers. Our contact information is on it, and you can just call and find out what we are doing, and whether it's in relationship to Honduras or Nicaragua or Cuba. And we hope that you'll all get involved and also use us along with other organizations that are actively involved in trying to get the truth out, to get information so you can share it with your constituents. Larry?
Thank you, Reverend Walker. What are some of the groups and movements, not only here but around the world, in support of Celaya's return, doing towards that end? And are there any contingency plans for movements in the event that there is a military attack on the Brazilian embassy?
I had an interesting thought, because I thought about that. I would think that if there were an attack by Honduras on either of the embassies that are showing support in Honduras for Zelaya right now, that would probably backfire on them, you know, seriously. Early in this whole process, Chavez hinted at and suggested the possibility of an invasion of Honduras. And given the total, the unanimity of nations in the region and indeed in the world against the coup, I think, I mean, I'm not hopeful that it would happen, but if they did it, I think it would be a tremendous mistake, serious mistake, a tactical error on their part. There are a number of organizations and agencies in the U.S. that are doing work paralleling what we're doing. We've been calling a number of those to see how we could work together on some of the strategies that I just talked about, that were the mounting relationship to support for the general resistance. Certainly, we know that there's interest in IAC, we know that there's interest in the Kyogi Center, in Nicaragua Network, Peace Action in New Jersey. And we've been getting calls from groups in various parts of the country, down in Texas, in Chicago, and on the west coast. So there are real serious pockets of interest, and we want to tap into those to encourage a growing response that could culminate in a serious protest action in D.C. If it comes to that. Over here.
Thanks for the great presentation. I'm sorry to get the news about Honduras out right now. It's so important, like you said. And we've had actions in Los Angeles in support of getting communications away. But I was curious about, because we've also had demonstrations about the Brazil's role in Haiti as the head of the UN forces there, which are part of the U.S. Congressional Haiti. But the U.S. kind of encouraged Brazil to do that. I'm wondering, since they might attack and they're threatening the Brazilian embassy, and it's at the behest of the U.S. because the publicity shows that, the silence shows the publicity. I wonder if that's going to affect the relationship, what Brazil's thinking right now about whether it should be an aid or not. How Brazil is thinking about being pushed into taking that role in Haiti by the U.S. if the U.S. is also going to attack it.
The developments that I've just described could result in some dynamic changes in the alignments, the balance of powers, the way we look at political development in the region. I think this is such a profoundly crucial moment that we really have to be reevaluating and constantly looking at what the implications are and how the forces will line up. What's very clear is that on no other issue is there any greater unanimity right now than around the lack of support for the coup regime and for support for Zelaya. You know, we don't really know how Zelaya got in. He says that he walked across a border and that he had to do a lot of walking through the country. When I saw him after he was in the embassy there, he still had his mustache, you know, that landmark mustache, still had his cowboy hat. There didn't seem to be anything different. And so one begins to wonder, how did a person with such distinguishing features walk hours upon hours through the country and through the border protected by various security forces, the army, the customs, immigration. He might have had a lot more support out of the Honduran army than we're being told, for one thing. And he certainly is now in a position to rally support for him in a way that he wasn't before. And it could result in a realignment of forces in a very significant way. And I think it's too early to tell exactly what that will be. But the powerful, wonderful thing is that there seems to be a popular support in the country for the Honduran government to move in the direction of Venezuela and Brazil and countries that are showing a positive bent. And that's a good thing. Yes.
Do you think there's any difference between the position of the White House and the State Department and Langley and the Department of Defense, or is it a U.S. position? You seem to say that Obama, you seem to make that distinction that somehow and in the movement, pro-Zelaya movement in among Americans, there is that consider a misconception that somehow Obama is different. There's a different policy emanating from the White House and from the State Department and Langley. So is there one policy? Is there a U.S. policy or is there a State Department policy and a Langley policy?
I think there's one policy, but I think it gets expressed differently by different spokespersons. And that's sometimes done in diplomatic government circles to confuse and to prevent the administration from being pinned down on one position. So it's one person talks about a troubled situation and Honduras, another calls it a coup, another calls it a military coup. But it may be just different words. But as long as the U.S. is not seriously addressing the issue and offering support and using its considerable power to bring Honduras to its knees economically, then one has to assume that its actions speak louder, or the lack of action, speak louder than the words. And so I'm not trying to excuse Obama. Frankly, I think he probably spoke initially without consulting with some of the folk in the administration who have their own history and their own ties and their own
agenda,
nuanced ways of saying things. And he's going to have to learn to have more control of his own people. And that's certainly true, we've seen in a number of other areas. I can know a little bit more about Cuba. The fact is that in the case of Cuba, the Obama speaks about a change, but he hasn't changed his personnel. The people who advise him on Cuba policy are the same people who were in the Bush and the Clinton administration. He hasn't brought fresh minds and a new perspective to those positions. So I think we're within this first year, we're in a place where we're going to see different nuances in the responses. But bottom line, for us who are going to be in solidarity and supporting the people's resistance, we have to demand that there be a clear, unequivocal support for the return to office of the democratically elected president, and nothing less should be acceptable.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm very, very much of a